Hello and welcome. My name is Blonna Tracy and this is my podcast, Untold. Across this 10-part series, I'll be taking a look at different facets of Irish society and speaking to people with unique voices and stories. This is a bonus episode that I released in conjunction with episode 2, Dating Abuse, where I speak with an amazing young woman called Avril, who shares her experience of an abusive relationship. In this bonus episode, I speak with Sarah Benson, the CEO of Women's Aid, a leading national organisation that has been working in Ireland to stop domestic violence against women and children since 1974. I could listen to Sarah speak for hours. She has so much wisdom and advice to share. I hope that you enjoy this chat and find it insightful. So Sarah Benson, thank you so much for meeting with me. I really appreciate your time. You're a very busy lady. So if you just tell me a little bit about what you do with Women's Aid.
Great. Well, I'm currently the CEO of Women's Aid. So it's a national organisation. We're based here in Dublin, but we have the National Free Phone Helpline. And we also have direct services here in the Greater Dublin area. So that's one-to-one outreach services where women can meet face-to-face with one of our great services team just to talk about what's going on. That can sometimes then also lead to court accompaniment support, which an awful lot of women really find beneficial. And then we do have a dedicated family law court here in Dublin called Dolphin House, and Women's Aid has a support and referral service that operates mornings. It's a drop-in service, totally confidential, just to give women information and advice around the whole court process, which is particularly helpful if they have nobody with them and they don't know what they're doing.
So. Exactly. And a really daunting thing to actually go through as well. I mean, are there laws in place to protect women and people in general in terms of domestic violence situations?
Yes, there's legislation. We've had legislation that actually has just recently been updated. So the most recent iteration of our domestic violence legislation is the Domestic Violence Act 2018, which commenced at the beginning of this year, 2019. And that covers a broad range of potential legal protections that a victim of domestic abuse and domestic violence can take. And it is a gender neutral piece of legislation, as you say. So that covers any party. So that can range from what we call protective orders. So in the past, with our previous legislation, it really was pretty well restricted to people who were in relationships where they were cohabiting. And often post separation, it left people very, very vulnerable, because we know ourselves from, you know, speaking with so many thousands of women over the years, that the relationship ending doesn't mean the abuse ends.
Exactly.
So now our legislation covers not only those who are married, it covers those who are in dating relationships. It also covers those who are not cohabiting and even have never cohabited together. So it's great. It now actually potentially covers a far broader number of people who might need it.
Exactly, because I think people often find themselves in situations where, am I being abused now? They've got my passwords to all of my online accounts. They're kind of stalking me online. They've got images of me and they're threatening to use them to blackmail me. That sort of stuff. Like, that is all abuse, and the safety orders are there to be put in place to protect you. Wasn't that right?
Well, that's a really interesting particular form of abuse that you raise, because the legislation isn't robust in protecting people against online stalking and harassment.
Really?
In fact.
Oh, okay.
So while you might have certain behaviours that could constitute abuse, you know, to the extent where one feels in fear and that the impact is so severe on your life that a protective order would be something that somebody might wish to go for. Where you have a situation of online image-based abuse, I mean, it has sometimes been called revenge porn, but that's actually a term I personally and the organisation takes issue with, because it seems to imply, A, that somebody did something to warrant revenge, and also that it's porn, and it's neither of those things. It's actually a form of online sexual abuse. And a single issuing of an intimate picture, whether it was shared consensually in the first instance or not, or whether it was taken consensually or not, irrespective, that can have absolutely devastating consequences, particularly for women. It has a very distinct gendered profile in terms of both the prevalence of how often women might be subjected to that abuse, but also the impact on women as opposed to men, for example, who might have an intimate image shared. So we don't have legislation that really effectively covers that. We have one piece of legislation which broadly covers stalking and harassment. It's an old piece of legislation from 1997, but that talks about a pattern of behaviour. But if you have a single incident where a photo or a video is put up online, and so it's a single incident, and yet then that becomes shared and shared and shared and shared and shared, there isn't a secure protection under the law for that. It's something that Women's Aid, which as another key part of our work is advocacy and campaigning and awareness raising, including where there are gaps in legislation, has been pushing quite hard for, because it's something certainly that we are hearing women say they experience. And we also are particularly concerned that younger women are especially vulnerable, and even young women and girls who may not have it happen even in the context of a dating relationship. It may happen in the context of peer relationships, things like that.
Exactly.
So really vulnerable to that form of abuse.
Yes. And I of course, came into contact with you guys through the Two Into You campaign, which I'm involved with, and it's kind of aimed at younger women. And the dating landscape has completely changed. I mean, with, you know, online dating apps, and there's all of this pressure, in fact, actually to share images like that, a huge amount of pressure on younger women and teenagers. And it's interesting. Do you think that the laws will ever actually catch up with the landscape that we're at right now?
Well, the law really does need to catch up. We need to have some legal instrument. But what we also know is that we need a civil instrument as well, because very commonly where people are subjected to this form of abuse, it isn't necessarily the case that their ultimate aim is to punish the perpetrator of that abuse to get some justice in the courts. What they absolutely want is the image taken down, and they want the legal remit and wherewithal to have it removed. And so there's currently two pieces of legislation that are stuck effectively in the Oireachtas. One is a criminal piece of legislation, but the other is a civil piece of legislation. And in it, it also calls for a data commissioner who would be perhaps the an office, a dedicated office, which would be tapped into having the resources and the authority for what you might have as takedown orders, which don't require people to pursue a criminal case against the perpetrator, but get them the result that they want.
Yeah.
So that's something we would see as a big, big gap at the moment.
OK, but you're aiming to close that gap.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. All the time. You guys are constantly campaigning, always trying to update the laws and have more kind of safeguards in place for people experiencing abuse in any form, really.
Yeah. We, along with civil society organisations, so we wouldn't have been alone by any stretch. There's many other great organisations out there that would have pushed very hard for the Domestic Violence Act. We also had the Sexual Offences Act. Again, was a very broad civil society campaign, cross-cutting many, many different organisations who saw the value in us updating legislation around issues like consent and sexual exploitation, things like that.
Yeah.
So it does require raising public awareness, though, because in effect, to change laws, you need to ensure that, you know, our legislators hear that this is an issue that their voters care about.
And exactly.
So it isn't just us. It is about getting a social response to say, no, this is needed.
I think that domestic abuse and violence is still such a taboo subject. It really, really is. And it's so prevalent in our society, but we're all still turning a blind eye to it, to abuse in relationships, like that power kind of control that we see sometimes in relationships. And it's just like, oh, he's just very overprotective or whatever. Why is it still so taboo? Why haven't we copped on and opened our eyes? And why don't we speak out?
What I would like to say is that I've been working in this area for over 20 years. And I would observe definitely that the conversation has opened up, that it has moved on, that the level of stigma has reduced. However, it hasn't reduced enough and the conversation hasn't opened up enough. So we have to keep talking about it. The voices of survivors who have the courage to come forward, and many can't because it's simply not safe to do so, or because the consequences have been so deep that they don't want to expose themselves publicly. You know, they're going through their own healing processes, and that's really important. So those who do have the courage to speak out are all the more exceptional for doing so. But what really happens then is people start to hear the story of women who could be their next door neighbour, could be their sister, could be their college classmate, could be their aunt. And it makes it real for people, and people realise that there's a huge human cost to this, and just how prevalent it is and how insidious it can be as well, because the tactics of an abusive partner often include, in fact, often are founded on trying to blame the victim for their own abuse and make them believe that it's their fault, that they're stupid. If they did something different, that that he would behave better. And we have now a growing recognition of those kind of insidious psychological, emotional forms of abuse. And indeed, a really important change in our legislation was the introduction of an offence called coercive control.
Okay.
Which is designed to really put a legal standing on those very deliberate, but on their own, small incremental forms of abuse, which have the cumulative impact of often completely isolating somebody, making them doubt their own sanity in some cases, make them have to start to see every decision and every action they take in their lives, no matter how mundane, through the lens of the person who's abusing them, because they have to kind of second guess, well, what will he do if I do this? What will happen if I do that? So highly controlling behaviour, which has the consequence of literally taking control of somebody's life. It's referred to as a liberty crime by some experts in the field, because it has the consequence of robbing someone of their liberty. And yet, sometimes to the outside world, even to sometimes to people close by, they can feel perhaps that something's wrong, but they can't see the overt manifestation of it other than, you know, certain signs. And there are signs, you know, where people become more withdrawn. They're watching the clock all the more. They're vigilant to getting messages, reacting very quickly to them, you know, saying no more and more and more to social occasions, things like that. But it is an incremental and cumulative form of abuse.
Okay.
And sometimes I recall myself from doing the frontline work on our helpline in the past, where women would just say, I literally can't believe that this is where I am now. 18 months ago, you know, this was the woman I was, and now I'm just a shell of that woman. I don't even really know how it happened. And then she starts to unpack it, and actually then the pattern emerges.
Exactly. And I think, I mean, I've read a lot of people's stories, and you hear that it's this slowly but surely chipping away at their confidence, and kind of, you know, oh, why don't you hang out with me tonight? Why do you want to hang out with your friends? And that's slowly kind of isolating them and slowly taking control of their finances. Or why are you wearing that? Why are you wearing makeup? I think you look beautiful without makeup. Are you trying to attract somebody else? So it's all of these small things, but I mean, they're not that small, but they do kind of, they all add up.
They all add up.
And and then you're left, as you say, kind of looking back going, hang on, how did I become this person? This isn't who I am. And I mean, for people who are family members of people who are in these situations, what are the red flags for them? How can they see, hang on, there's something not right here? Mm. What should they look out for?
Yeah, well, I mean, some of the things I've already highlighted there, somebody being a little bit more insulated, isolated, where they seem less confident in themselves, where they cut short, you know, what would have been, you know, longer engagements, meeting for coffee becomes a very short affair, where they appear, as I mentioned, vigilant, you know, vigilant to any kind of, like, so they may be getting a lot of text messages, and they'd be looking very quickly to see and make sure that they respond. They may have to leave quickly. But a lot of it is just around someone's demeanor as well, just how they seem in themselves, how confident they are. Often, you know, really vibrant and, you know, intelligent, outgoing people suddenly, you know, become far more withdrawn. And so for families who are concerned, I mean, we do have a number of resources on our website, or then there's the dedicated Two Into You website as well, which are signs of a healthy relationship, and then the inverse, which are the signs of an unhealthy relationship. And that can give people themselves, if they feel there might be something wrong with their relationship, or family members or friends who are concerned, just a few of the steers, just to think, okay, well, you know, something doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
And what we would always say to, you know, people who have a loved one that they're concerned about is, you know, making sure that they know that you're always there.
Yes.
Not pushing them to make decisions, but trying to create open and safe spaces to have a conversation. So you don't seem yourself, is everything okay? You know, whatever way would work with that particular person. Not to press them to take action, but rather to create an environment where they might just be able to speak about what's going on. And I think it's important to, you know, acknowledge that most, you know, women who experience domestic abuse will have experienced it for a long, long, long time before they even articulate it.
Exactly.
So sometimes coming from an absolute place of love, family can feel like, well, we must rush in and take action. And that can be very alarming. to somebody who hasn't quite got to grips with what's going on themselves. It can cause them a level of panic. If somebody's in a survival mode where they are simply coping day to day, it can actually feel quite threatening, even though it's coming from, you know, the best place in the world. So, you know, going slow and making sure and just creating safe space, saying, you know, I'm always here, you know, if there's anything you need.
Yeah.
And then if somebody does start to open up, to work with them at their pace, to make them aware that there's resources there. You know, we have the National Helpline. It's free. It's 24 hours a day. We also can signpost women to any and all of the services right across the country, you know, just to make them aware of what's available in their local communities as well, if they're not based in Dublin.
And can family members ring up the helpline as well?
Absolutely, they can.
Because that's great, because I think that often people don't have the language to use. They don't know what are the right things to say. Do I want to use the word abuse? I've never seen him hit her. But abuse doesn't actually mean physical violence. Abuse often comes in years of psychological abuse and this kind of conditioning and almost like brainwashing somebody before they'll experience any violence at all. So it's almost like trying to get in early and see those signs.
Yeah, and language can be frightening for people who haven't accepted that language for their own experience, and that can cover the whole spectrum of, you know, abusive and violent experiences, from, you know, including rape, including as you say, an abusive relationship. And language is important, and it is, you know, something we would always encourage people to do if they're trying to connect with someone they're concerned about, is not to put words in their mouth and let them just speak about what's going on. And there are ways. I mean, somebody may say, oh, he's very abusive, and then that's okay. You have the signpost to say, they're okay with that word. But there are other ways that are no less powerful to convey, you know, in a way that might feel better for somebody, where they're just still trying to tease things out. Just go, well, that doesn't, you know, that doesn't sound like he's treating you very well there, or, you know, well, how does that feel? I think I'd find that quite difficult. How do you find it? You know, much more gentle ways to draw it out. So really, it's about taking your lead always from that person.
Exactly.
And then at a certain point, there can be a value if someone has set out a scenario which objectively we would see it as being abusive, is to say, well, you know, you may not identify that, but that actually fits the definition of what domestic abuse would be called. You know, I'm not, you know, maybe you haven't even thought about it that way, but just listening, you know. So but always with care.
Exactly. And the thing is, when I've read some of these stories, you hear a lot of survivors saying things like, you know, people always ask the question, why didn't you leave? And it's an infuriating question, because it's coming from an uneducated point of view. You know, this woman or person has been abused for such a long period of time, and all of a sudden you're kind of saying, well, this is sort of your own fault. Why didn't you get out of it?
Yeah.
And then, you know, that's the wrong way going about it.
Yeah,
you know,
unfortunately, that does still happen. Or, you know, people with the best will in the world give those messages without even necessarily realizing they do.
Yeah.
You know, that still lingers for sure. And I suppose one of the things that, you know, we do training with members of the Gardaí, for example, on their practice on domestic violence, which is great and really valuable. And they're a brilliant potential resource, and they are the only ones who have, you know, the power to maybe intervene in a scenario if things get really dangerous.
Mm.
But we ask them, for example, well, what's the difference between domestic abuse, domestic violence, and any other crime, for example, like a mugging or a burglary? And when you start to unpack it, it becomes really clear just how complicated this is.
Yeah.
You know, in almost no other crime, you know, excepting, for example, sexual crimes, will the perpetrator be in an intimate relationship with the abuser? Will there have been the complicated scenario where they will have professed love at one moment and then been abusive in another? Would they share property together? Do they share children together?
Mm.
You know, leaving has, you know, huge consequences before you even get to considering the safety question. Because the other thing is that, you know, those who are victims of, or those who are surviving domestic abuse, will know their situation well, and we know, sadly and tragically, from research, is that one of the most dangerous times in a relationship is where the abusive and controlling partner thinks that there's a chance they may lose control i.e. when she might be considering leaving, or just after she's left. And so it is an extremely high risk proposition to leave an abusive and violent relationship, even if there hasn't been physical violence. That may be the point at which, in order to maintain control, maintain power, an abusive partner may escalate.
Okay.
And so, notwithstanding the safety, I think it's really important to remember the human intersections of an intimate relationship. And many, many victims of domestic abuse would say, certainly, you know, maybe it really depends on their circumstances, but it wouldn't be uncommon to hear them say, I actually, you know, I don't even necessarily want the relationship to end, you know, I just want the abuse to stop.
Yeah.
Because one of the ways that abusive men will try and manage a situation, so for example, if they're challenged about their behavior and somebody says, well, they'll leave, they could escalate to violence. But the other thing they'll do is they'll de-escalate and they'll become exceptionally charming again, and they'll apologize and they'll say, didn't mean it. And that just, I mean, you know,
it's like
it messes with someone's head, really. Absolutely, does. And they keep moving the goalposts. You mentioned that example before where, you know, somebody says, well, you know, why do you need to wear makeup? You look beautiful without it. And then, you know, in, you know, a week later, might be just going, look at the state of you, you know, just letting yourself go. And then she might put makeup on, just going, well, look, what are you doing? You know, there's a constant it isn't about a continuous, you know, way that she will know how he's going to react. The whole point is, it just keeps changing, it just keeps moving. And so when someone's in that situation where they're just surviving moment to moment because they just don't know exactly what's going to happen, they can't predict, and they're trying and they're managing and they work so hard to do it, asking them why they don't leave really misses the issue, which
it's
is
a silly question.
What he's doing.
It really is. When you actually look at the facts, it is it's not the correct way of going about it. But I mean, the most important thing for anyone who's listening who thinks that they may be in a situation like this, the most important thing is that they get themselves out of it, but in a safe way. And Women's Aid do that. They help you get out of the situation, because you said that can actually be one of the more dangerous times in the relationship, is when you want to end it. So how do they do it?
Well, I think a first step is a great one is just to reach out and talk. And so the helpline we have, like I said, it's 24 hours a day. It's absolutely free. It's completely confidential. Don't have to give your name even if you don't want to. And we also have an interpreting service, a language line for anyone for whom English is not their first language.
Okay.
And that number is 1-800-341-900. And if somebody wants to phone, and then they might just explain what's going on for them, because there's no one size fits all response. So for some women, it may be about getting information about safety and protective orders that can at least give them a level of protection where they have, you know, the possibility to phone the guards if anything happens. That can be very important if somebody particularly is considering leaving, because then they have a legal protection in place to support them through quite a high risk period.
Okay.
We can support with court accompaniment, or we can signpost, as I say, to any of the regional other services who often also provide that as well.
Okay.
And then, you know, in some cases it's an outright emergency, and there are a number of refuges around the country which provide emergency accommodation for women and their children. And likewise, the helpline can signpost to those, give the contacts. Sometimes it's just matter just getting out in the moment and not hesitating. And I would say, you know, leaving can be a long process for some, it can be a shorter process for others. But if one feels one's in danger, we would always say phone the police.
Yeah.
Always.
Okay.
So that'd be phone 999. That is their function, that is their role. They have a policy on domestic violence. They now have a dedicated protective services bureau, which has a remit for domestic violence. And then regional bureaus are being set up across the country. So more and more and more, we hope we'll have actually specialised trained Gardaí.
Okay.
If in doubt, phone the guards.
Okay. And I think this is something that I've come across as well in my reading, that some women, it's like they don't think they've been abused enough. Like, what's the cutoff point? It's like, well, you know, he speaks to me like this, or he treats me like that, and he has control over my money, makes me feel like, but it's not, he's never put his hands on me, or it's never gotten that bad. Like, what is that? Is that just a thing that's in, is it an Irish psyche? Is it just women? Is it because they've been abused? Like, why do they not think even just a small amount of abuse is too much?
I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, part of it could be in the language, in that we have domestic violence and that word violence. And as your listeners may pick up throughout our entire conversation, we're kind of switching between abuse, violence, and, you know, in the law, it's termed domestic violence. But more and more and more, we find that using abuse is the more appropriate term, because it resonates more with those who perhaps aren't experiencing physical violence, because as you rightly said, violence doesn't have to be physical, but a lot of people, I think it is, or that's their default when you say abuse. You know, for anybody's individual situation, I think rather than looking at what he's doing and saying, is it, you know, would it constitute a level of abuse or not, is to reflect on what impact it is having. You know, and if the impact is that it feels wrong, that you're stressed, that you don't feel you have control, that you don't feel you can make choices for yourself, that you don't feel that you can access, for example, your own money, that you feel that this is somebody who doesn't respect you and indeed disrespects you, and that's having an impact on your confidence, on your well-being, then, you know, in all likelihood, that is an abusive relationship. And what we would say is nobody deserves that.
And there's just one more thing I wanted to ask you about. It's actually kind of, it's almost an area that people don't really touch on that much, but within those abusive relationships, that abuse goes into all parts of the relationship, including the more intimate side. And even using the word intimate doesn't sound right, because it's sexual abuse as well. You know, lots of women kind of use it almost as a means of sort of pleasing their partner. Okay, maybe if I keep him happy, he'll be nice to me this evening. Or if I know that if I say no, it's going to happen anyway, so I'm going to just go along with it. That issue of consent. And I mean, you must see that a lot with these relationships.
Yeah, and I'm glad you raised that. It is one of the most, it's a really difficult thing for somebody who's in an abusive relationship with an intimate partner to talk about, because it does get tangled up in all of those kind of tropes of, well, we're in a sexual relationship, therefore, you know, does consent have to happen every single time? You know, even if I'm tired, all of those things. But the fact is, if somebody is abusive and controlling in every other room in the house, of course, it's going to manifest itself in the bedroom as well.
Yeah.
But it is very difficult often for women to talk about. And often a space is required to actually open up the opportunity for them to do it. In my own experience, is to actually say, you know, sometimes, just as I said, you know, that somebody's abusive, that can also manifest itself in the bedroom. Is that something that's ever happened to you? And often when that's offered, you will get the yes, but people won't necessarily offer it up, because, you know, it's behind closed doors. It's not stranger. It's someone, you know, whom you profess to be physically attracted to. And you gave some really good examples of those scenarios that can happen. And it may not be, it's going to happen anyway if I don't say yes. The consequence could be he won't talk to me for 3 weeks, you know, if I don't. And therefore, it's this, you know, it may be seen as an appeasement, as it's just it's easier than.
Yeah.
But then they're like, but I didn't say no.
Exactly.
So it becomes very complicated. And then, of course, though, you also have reports of actually very extreme and very overt. And, you know, there's absolutely nothing ambiguous about it. You know, sexual abuse and violence that happens.
Yeah.
Rape that happens in the context of marriage. We have a sadly low number of successful convictions in this country for marital rape, and that would fit a pattern, you know, internationally as well, unfortunately. But I think it's really important that people know that rape within marriage is absolutely a crime.
Yes.
And indeed, you know, should be seen actually as a more aggravating circumstance, because it is such a violation of trust where you have committed to somebody and then you violate their trust in that way. So yes, it is absolutely something that happens. The Savvy report, which is a bit historic now, which was a prevalence of sexual violence in Ireland, found that a quarter of all reported rapes were in the context of a relationship.
Wow.
So I think that's really important not to forget that.
Isn't that just, even actually when you hear those facts and figures, they're actually people. That's your sister, it's your mum, it's your cousin, it's your best friend. And like, that's what's actually so shocking about it. I mean, can we actually have a look? Do you have, just off the top of your head, facts or numbers? I mean, what is the 1 in 5, is it? Or how many?
1 in 5, that would be women experiencing domestic abuse in this country. That is from our own research, but it's a little historical now. And there was a more recent piece of research which kind of disaggregated out the experiences, which found in relation to emotional psychological abuse, it could be as many as over 30% of women in this country, and then slightly less in relation to reported physical and sexual abuse. But in terms of in the UK, it would be one in four.
Yeah.
We'd say that's probably a fairly safe bet. But the Fundamental Rights Agency research is the last one that actually focused on Ireland.
Yeah.
But what we do know is that of all of the criminal behaviours, it is one of the most prevalent in our society. If you think of any other form of criminal behaviour, it is not going to affect a quarter of the female population.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to just ask you about is violence in same-sex relationships. I know that obviously Women's Aid is mainly focused on women, but it is prevalent. It does happen in same-sex relationships. And obviously it happens in relationships where women are violent to their male partners as well. Are you seeing more people getting in touch with Women's Aid asking about help in regards to that?
Yeah, well, over the years, Women's Aid will never turn anybody away who's picked up the phone to reach out. And we would have supported certainly lesbian women over the years. And we would have had contact from men who may be in same-sex relationships. And we might have referred them for support, for example, to the LGBT helpline. At the moment, we are ourselves kind of, in our own planning phase for, our next, strategic plan. And part of that is actually reaching out and consulting with a number of different stakeholder groups to say, well, how can we, understand perhaps some of the maybe slightly different, more specific experiences that LGBT people experience, and how can we then inform our own selves about providing support services. It is true to say that the experiences of say men in a gay relationship will mirror, and I say this hesitantly because I'm not an expert in the area, more just from the kind of level of research done so far, but their experiences may mirror much more that of women in a heterosexual relationship than men in a heterosexual relationship who experience abuse from their female partner.
Okay.
And certainly with male relationships, gay relationships, sexual abuse, that is something that definitely would be similar as well. I don't have the data on levels of, but I think it's important to note that where it happens, it's really important that no further stigma should be placed on somebody because of their sexuality or because of their gender. And that all the services need to make sure that we kind of work together to make sure nobody slips through the cracks in terms of support, information and advice that might be available. And likewise, there is a service for male victims as well, the Men's Advice Line. It's run by the Men's Development Network, and they support men who've experienced abuse from a female partner, which does happen, though. It would definitely be a smaller proportion because this is unfortunately a heavily gendered crime. But that doesn't mean that everybody who experiences it should be entitled to get the support that they need.
Exactly. And I mean, everybody knows now that they can contact Women's Aid. It doesn't matter if you're gay, straight, heterosexual, if you're a man or a woman, you will direct them in the right place.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. We would have the details for all the services I just mentioned.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. It's been eye-opening and kind of scary as well, because the numbers are still so high. But I think the more we talk about this, the more people will realise that they have an option, and the option is to get out, and there's somebody like Women's Aid there to give them a hand. So thank you so much.
Thanks.
I can't thank Sarah Benson enough, the CEO of Women's Aid. If you are in an abusive relationship, or you know somebody who is, please get in touch with Women's Aid right now. Women's Aid run a 24-hour free phone service, 1800 341 900, and an online service too, womensaid.ie. Thank you to Christina Sherlock and to Sarah Benson from Women's Aid for all of their guidance and their time. Thank you to Taz and Rian Kelleher for the finishing touches and the graphics. Thank you to sound engineer Colm O'Rourke. Thank you to my husband Charlie Moon for the beautiful music and support. And thank you to my agent Jane Russell for your encouragement. Finally, a huge thank you to all of you for listening, and I hope you like the podcast. If you do, please like, share and subscribe. Brand new episodes every Wednesday at 11:00.